Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, September 25th, 2013, during a live teleform conference call. Welcome to the Practice Group teleform conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing the new book, Dumbing Down the Courts, How Politics Keeps the Smartest Judges Off the Bench, by author John Lott. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. Professor John Lott is an economist who has held research and/or teaching positions at the University of Chicago, Yale University, Stanford, UCLA, Wharton, and Rice. He's published over 100 academic articles and is the author of 6 books. I don't know if that's 7 now or if it's still 6, but it's 8 books. Okay, we've got some outdated information, but 8 books now, including Dumbing Down the Courts, How Politics Keeps the Smartest Judges Off the Bench. That, of course, is a topic that I think should be of keen interest to Federalist Society members everywhere, so I'm glad you've joined the call. And a link to the Amazon webpage for the book was provided in notice of today's call, and of course it's available on the Federalist Society website as well. In his opening remarks, Professor Lott's going to discuss the book, the thesis statement of the book, for about 10 to 12 minutes. After that, we'll hear some commentary and questions from Kurt Levy, the president and executive director of the Committee for Justice. He's also a member of our Civil Rights Practice Group Executive Committee. And then after that, Professor Lott will take questions from the audience. So let's please begin, Professor Lott, with your opening remarks. The floor is yours.
Well, thanks very much, Dean. I greatly appreciate the Federalist Society allowing me to talk about this research that I've done. I've enjoyed listening to these teleforums myself in the past. I've been working on this since about 2004. It's been one of the longer projects I've worked on. If somebody looks at the book, I think they'll be surprised by the amount of information that's in it. I was motivated, as I'm sure a lot of people are, to look at this by what's become more vicious, more confrontational confirmation processes for judicial nominees over time. And I wanted to, at first, just try to explain why they've gotten so much more vicious and confrontational. But as I looked at the data more, it was clear that it wasn't just becoming more difficult for everyone, that there were certain patterns in terms of who it was becoming the most difficult for. And it turns out it's basically the brightest nominees, those who would be the most influential if they were on the court, face by far the most difficult time. And as you've been seeing an increase in the difficulties in getting people confirmed over time, it's particularly these brightest nominees who have seen the biggest increases in the most difficult times getting confirmed. Now, there are two theories, basically, about one explaining why the process has become much more difficult, and the other one to say why it's the brightest nominees that have faced the most difficult time. The first one is simply that more is at stake, that as we've seen a huge explosion since 1960 in cases going to federal courts, as we've had proliferation of regulatory agencies from everything from the EPA to Consumer Product Safety Commission to OSHA to FEC, cases that previously wouldn't go to federal courts now go there. One could also argue that in terms of judges' willingness to insert their own personal views, both have contributed to making it so that more is at stake on who gets to be a judge and has increased the battles there. Why it's the brightest ones that have had the most difficult time, I'm sure people who are practicing lawyers have had to deal with questions about who they put on a jury, for example. I'll give you one analogy that I kind of ran across a few years ago. Greg Mankiw, who's the chairman of the Hartford Economics Department and former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, was called up for jury duty and based really on nothing more than what his occupation was. He was knocked off the jury. And, you know, he was asking, well, why should that be the case? Why should the fact that I'm a professor at Harvard make him undesirable to serve on a jury? But I think, as I say, lawyers who are involved in this type of thing know what's going on there, and that is he's worth more than one vote. I mean, being a professor at Harvard, it's kind of his job to be persuasive. He's articulate. He's able to get his ideas across. And if you think he's leaning even slightly one way or the other, the lawyer who thinks he may be slightly leaning against him is going to strike him, maybe strike him more than some other nominee or some other juror who might even be more biased, simply because he's worth so many votes compared to that alternative juror. Well, the same thing is true with regard to judicial nominees. It's not just focusing on how an individual judge will rule when they're on the court, but the impact that they'll have on other judges, whether it be on their panels, whether you're talking about circuit or Supreme Court justices, or writing opinions that are going to influence other judges around the country. And I'll get back to this in a little bit about kind of the data to show what the results are. But just first of all, just to talk about how the judicial process, confirmation process, has changed over time. Most people focus on the Supreme Court. Obviously, that's the one that gets the attention. We've seen the biggest changes, though, in terms of how difficult it is for confirmations at the lower courts, particularly the circuit courts, particularly the D.C. Circuit Court, and to a lesser extent, but still very noticeable, at the district court level. I can give you just some numbers on this so you get an idea. If you look at the Supreme Court, from 1900 to the end of the Ford administration in 1976, it took about 23 days to confirm the average Supreme Court nominee. 80% of those, or almost 80%, were confirmed within less than a month. About 40% of those were confirmed in less than 10 days. From Reagan on, no one's been confirmed in less than a month, and the average days are about 76 days. So there's been some increase. If you look at circuit courts, for example, during the Carter and Reagan administrations, you'd be talking about 68, 69 days to confirm a circuit court judge. That would go up to about 92 days under Bush 1. Under Clinton, it went to 231 days. Under Bush 2, it went to 362 days. And under Obama, during his first term, it was 268 days. There's a lot of discussion in the media that I think is wrong about the length of time and the confirmation process, and that is they don't follow people all the way to the end. So when they'll go and they'll say the confirmation rate for Obama is worse than it's been for other presidents, they don't include the fact that Obama tends to, compared to other presidents, nominate judges towards the end of a congressional term. And they simply don't have time in that term. You know, people who are nominated in June or July, right before an election, aren't going to be handled. But they're usually quickly confirmed at the beginning of the next year. So if you look at confirmation rates for circuit court judges, under Carter it was 93%, under Reagan it was 89%, 78% under Bush 1, 74% under Clinton, 72% under Bush 2. And now it's up to 85% under Obama. You basically have to go back to Reagan to get anything even close. His nominees maybe weren't confirmed by last November or December at the end of his first term, but they were taken care of earlier this year, a large percentage of them. It's still, though, the general trend is to make things more difficult, much more costly to get through. And we see this impact in many ways. Just give you a couple statistics to give you an idea of how the process has changed. If you look at nominees who went to a top 10 law school and were on the law review, it took them about 65% longer to get confirmed than someone who didn't go to a top school and didn't do particularly well in their class. If you add on things like whether they also clerked for an appeals court judge and then for a Supreme Court justice, that total time then would be about 158% longer for somebody who went to a top law school, was on the law review, clerked for an appeals court judge and a Supreme Court judge. It takes them 158% longer to go through the confirmation process than someone who doesn't have any of those characteristics. And they're also about 37% less likely to get confirmed. Presidents have long been willing to, or more interested in nominating people from top law schools, though that's declined somewhat over time. But the big effect has been this huge change in their ability to get those people through to be confirmed. Now, probably a more direct measure of influence of judges is to look at citations to them by other judges of their opinions. And obviously there's a few real standouts that we could talk about, Posner and Easterbrook and Harvey Wilkinson during the period of time that I've looked at from Carter through the beginning of Obama. But what's interesting is that just a little bit more citations, how that, to your opinions, how that makes it so much more difficult to get confirmed. If you get about 20% more citations to your judicial opinions from other judges, that increases the length of the confirmation process by up to about 60%. And obviously we can't get the guys who didn't get confirmed, but for those who did, even within that range, you see quite a noticeable change that's there. Now, I have a long chapter on the American Bar Association and its behavior in terms of nominations. If you think about kind of the way they rank them, well-qualified, well-qualified, and so on, each one of those units, if you think of that as kind of each one of those gaps as one unit, that's about the average difference between Republicans and Democrats nominees after you control for like where they went to law school, aspects of their legal career, other things. So like the average Democrat would get well-qualified, qualified. The average Republican circuit court nominee would get qualified, well-qualified. But that really hides kind of the bias that's there. And you can only really get this when you have the really large data set with all the nominees from Carter through the end of Bush 2 that I have. So, for example, one of the ways they hide it is how they rate judges based on their age. An old Republican, every once in a while you'll see a 60-year-old Republican being nominated. He'll get an incredibly high ABA rating. Young Republicans, though, will get very low, much lower than you would predict based on their characteristics. For Democrats, it's the reverse. Old Democrats will get a very low rating. Young Democrats will get a very high rating. I think it has a lot to do with how long people think that they're going to remain on the court. The other thing is, they don't have this bias all the time. It shows up when you have split control between the president and the Senate. If you have a Republican president and a Democratic Senate, then you'll see very low ABA ratings for the Republican nominees. If you have a Democratic president, Republican Senate, you'll see very high ratings for the nominees. So I can go into that type of discussion more. But if you care about, you know, the bottom line is, I should also say I have a lot of information on how life expectancy and tenure of judges have changed over time, also in one of the chapters in the book. But if you care about having the brightest, most influential nominees on the courts, then this has been a huge change. You definitely see that people who have kind of the best pedigrees or end up being the most influential have a harder time getting there. Presidents are less likely to nominate them, and they're less likely to get confirmed. And something that affects nominees from both parties, though brighter, smarter, more influential Republicans have a somewhat more difficult time getting confirmed than the same thing is true for bright Democrats. Thank you very much. Hello?
Yeah. Kurt Levy, your remarks?
Well, first of all, thank you, Dean, and to the Federalist Society for asking me to comment on this important book. I guess I should reveal my own bias. My organization, the Committee for Justice, was set up in 2002 as a response to the obstruction of Bush's judicial nominees, you know, not judicial nominees in general. I'd like to think that we've become a little bit more nonpartisan since then, but again, our mission has focused on the wrongs committed, let's say, by Democratic senators, and so I just want to get that out of the way. But, you know, putting politics aside, one of the most frustrating things about what's been for me now 8 years of working on this is it's so hard to get good statistics. You know the saying about lies, damn lies, and statistics, and I've never seen that, you know, more vividly than an additional confirmation process where whether you're a Republican or a Democratic senator, you can put out a press release with statistics that make the other side look horrible, and it doesn't really matter what's going on. There's always statistics you can find. So, you know, it's good to see John collect a lot of statistics in one place where it's not just cherry-picking, and also the fact that he's done it, the collection of data that is more comprehensively than I've ever seen before, you know, both in terms of the number of factors that he looks at and the number of administrations that he looks at. So while I will try to find some areas of disagreement to make this interesting, I you know, like what John has done, and I'll mostly just focus on what I found interesting. I mean, you know, I guess at the highest level, it's sort of nice to see confirmation that what both sides have been saying is true. The nominees are delayed longer than they were in past decades. The problem is getting worse. The most qualified candidates are, you know, often the most ferociously attacked, and the differences aren't small. I won't, John mentioned some of the statistics, so I won't mention them again, but, you know, we're talking about the delays, you know, doubling, tripling, you know, from certainly from before the, you know, before Reagan became president. You know, I guess one thing I did find kind of funny was John says in there, you know, sort of the last period that you could really, you know, compare was when confirmation hearings were politicized and divisive during the Civil War. But he says even then it was nothing similar to our recent battle. So that's reassuring to know that it's even worse than the Civil War at this point. That's not a good thing. I mean, I found that somewhat amusing, but obviously that's not a good thing. I think everyone can agree that the politicization of the process is not a good thing. How to stop it? That's a much harder question. You know, John does a very you know, goes out of his way to try to be nonpartisan here and to try to say that the problem is symmetric. I guess that's probably where I would most disagree with him. He has a quote where he says, I'll just read it. He said, how did the judicial confirmation process become so nasty? Democrats say Republicans started it. Republicans say Democrats did. I don't think that's quite true. Certainly, there are tons of Democrats who will say that Republicans have, you know, brought it to a new level, that despite, you know, us obstructing Bush's nominees, you know, Republicans are even worse now. But I don't know a lot of Democrats who would say that Republicans started it. And I think that's because when you really look at what started it, it involved the blocking of Republican nominees. And, you know, John specifically talks about that. He talks about how this era started with really the attacks on William Rehnquist, who had, I think people forget now, but he had a very tough confirmation battle. He had about a third of the senators vote against him, which was, I believe was the highest ever for a Supreme Court justice confirmed at that point. And it was pretty vicious. I mean, John includes a quote from Senator Kennedy, says, "Justice Rehnquist might have made a brilliant 19th century chief justice, but the brilliance of judicial intellect in the service of racism and injustice is no virtue in our times." And that he was, in a sense, Senator Kennedy, that is, previewing what he would say about Bork a year later, since the Rehnquist confirmation was in 86. Still, the Democrats hadn't yet filibustered at that point. They didn't filibuster Rehnquist, but when the filibuster started, again, that was the Democrats doing it. The use of the judicial filibuster really started under the second President Bush. And then, of course, sort of the next ramping up was Bork in 87 and Thomas 4 years later. Now John also points out, although I don't think he means it to diminish the point about Bork being a turning point here, but he points out that one of the reasons people objected to Bork was his brilliant intellect. And I think that's probably true. John also points out that Justice Kennedy was confirmed despite everyone pretty much, well, I don't know if Kennedy's mother agrees, but pretty much everyone else agreeing that Kennedy was not brilliant in the way that Robert Bork was. And, I hadn't really thought about that, but I think, sort of the conventional wisdom is that Kennedy got through easily because he was more moderate, but it's probably also true that it's because he wasn't as, his intellect was not as intimidating. And again, even John's own statistics, when he talks about how the average confirmation process for circuit nominees was about 230 days under Clinton, and then it grew to about 360 days under the second President Bush. But then under President Obama, it's kind of gone back to the Clinton numbers, about 250. And I realize the Obama administration is still going on. But, I think it's that's one indication that it's been worse for Republican nominees. And even for Supreme Court justices, John makes it a point to say, although the length of the confirmation process has been increasing since Reagan, the one exception was during Clinton. It took a dip. So, again, I think while it's certainly true that both sides have played this game, it's not quite symmetric. Where I can't disagree with John at all is sort of what's led to this, where he says that it's really the increasing power of the courts and the increasing, judicial activism that's led to this. And it's not just judicial activism. It's also we live in a society where, everything can be litigated, everything is litigated. John points out that the number of circuit court cases per American has gone up 10 times since the 1960s. For district court cases, I think it's about tripled. So we just are becoming a more litigious society. Even if judges were still neutral interpreters of the law and constitution, there's just a lot more at stake when everyone is running to court. And Ed Meese is one of the people who has praised this book, and Ed has a quote in there where he says, I'll read it, "The surest fix to this drawn-out confirmation battle is to ensure that judges adhere to their proper role." I mean, that's probably the only way to put the genie back in the bottle, is to, if judges were less political, the confirmation process would be less political. And John goes, into a discussion of, which issues have sort of contributed the most to making this highly politicized. Certainly abortion is a big one. Roe, and even before that, Griswold. Race has been a huge issue. Affirmative action, desegregation. Now we're getting into gay marriage being, not just gay marriage, really, gay rights in general, being very much determined by the courts. Just take abortion. In some sense, the more activist, the victory for, you know, in the case of abortion, the left, the more important it is to have Supreme Court justices, you know, that have ideology. I mean, if you're trying to protect precedents that are well grounded in the text, it's not so important to have judges that have the right ideology. But the worse, in a sense, the more weakly grounded the precedent, the more important it is to have Supreme Court justices and lower court judges with the right ideology. I'll tell you one thing that was I didn't know. John pointed out that despite the fact that everyone thinks of abortion as the big issue in judges' fights, that at least until recently, race was the biggest fight. He says during Rehnquist confirmation process, there were almost three times as many news stories mentioning race than mentioning abortion. Similar figures, not quite as skewed for Scalia. So if it's true that abortion has become the biggest issue, you know, it's not, certainly not since Roe. It would be a more recent phenomena. Let's see. The other factors that struck me that John talked about was the increased polarization of the Senate. I mean, certainly everyone agrees that the Senate has become more polarized. And, you know, it's almost unimaginable that that would not make the confirmation battles more more polarized. I think John seems unsure about whether televising Judiciary Committee hearings for Supreme Court justices has made it more polarized. He points out that that's, you know, the televising them is relatively recent, started with O'Connor, so we're talking the last 30 years. There is sort of a chicken and egg problem there, you know. Does televising them make them more political, or is it that people are getting more interested in the process because it's more political, and that's why the networks broadcast it? It's hard to know, but I suspect that televising them, you know, turns them into at least somewhat more of a circus than they would otherwise be. He also talks about outside groups, you know, certainly the rise of outside groups, first on the left and then on the right, you know, contribute. I mean, I run one of those outside groups, and, you know, there's no question that, you know, it's like lawyer, you know, what do they say about lawyers in general? If everyone was good, we wouldn't need lawyers. Well, you know, if the judicial confirmation process was not highly politicized, we wouldn't need these outside groups, and I guess I'd be out of a job. Although, again, you have the chicken and egg problem. I did, you know, John, I have to say, I didn't know you actually quote the Committee for Justice when you say that within a few hours of Sandra Day O'Connor announcing her her resignation, we apparently issued a press release that said we will be watching Senate Democrats and intend to link moderate and red state senators to their liberal Senate colleagues and outside groups. And indeed, we did that. I didn't realize we were that quick. I didn't join CFJ till a month after that, so I wasn't being aware of that. And, you know, maybe the saddest thing about everything John discusses is the fact that being smart hurts. As he says, it's perfectly rational. If the courts are going to be used to achieve policy goals, then it is better to pick people who don't have as good a mind for not just law, but probably politics and policy as well. You know, certainly I'll admit that, you know, certainly not all the times we've opposed Obama nominees, but at least with Goodwin Liu, one of the things that concerned us, beside the fact that he, you know, was an unbridled embracer of a living constitution, and the fact that everyone knew Obama wants to put him on the Supreme Court, you know, Goodwin Liu is very, very smart. I mean, I've been impressed when I've talked to him or heard him speak, and, you know, that was definitely one of the reasons that people feared him. I guess, you know, the fact that people that you know, the smartest nominees are being blocked might be, you know, the surest proof, you know, that you know, we're no longer looking for judges to be judges. I mean, if we were really looking for judges to give the best, you know, the best, most correct answers, we'd want the smartest people. It's you know, it's the very fact that that's not what we want that makes us fear smart people.
Well, Kurt, this is Dean. I want to try and turn to the audience pretty soon.
Sure.
Gonna, make a final observation, and then we'll see if the audience has questions for Professor Lott.
Sure. I guess I'll just add a couple of quick more points. One was, you know, John also talks about he interviewed some of the nominees and goes through the personal toll that this has taken on nominees. And I would add that I think that also dumbs down the courts because, you know, very talented people usually have very good jobs already. They have less to gain from becoming judges and thus less reason to put themselves through a horrible process. And they have more reputation to lose. So I think, you know, I think that's another factor going on. And finally, I guess I'd say that, you know, it's funny, despite all this, we still see presidents nominating people from the top schools. Now, of course, going to the top law schools does not mean you're smart, but hopefully there's some correlation. And, you know, one of the biggest complaints right now is that about makeup of the Supreme Court is they all went to the top few law schools. So anyway, I just found that a little bit ironic. And, you know, besides the fact that it's good for the country, I hope we get back to a time when this is less politicized. It's certainly made for more informative judicial confirmation hearings. I mean, confirmation hearings have just become pretty much absent of substance at this point, and that's another loss because it's one of the times when Americans pay attention and learn about the judicial process, and I better stop there.
All right. As promised, let's turn to the audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our panelists today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Professor John Lott, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we have at least two callers with questions, so let's go to our first question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Back in the 50s, the common lawyer quip was that a judge was someone who couldn't make it as a lawyer. So this is not a new problem. It's been with us throughout our history. What has changed somewhat is that partisans are able to seize on the evidence of the positions that a person is likely to take as a judge, his writings, his decisions, and perhaps if he was working for the government, the cases he took and the sides he argued when he was in that capacity. But there's a general anti-intellectual climate in Washington. I spent 2 years there and found that the halls of power are overwhelmingly composed of mediocre intellects who view with suspicion anyone who actually knows anything. And the reason why they do is because they can't control them. So this is a much larger problem than just judges. And if we are not going to run into the ditch, we're going to need to deal with it. But I would like to ask about a proposed solution, at least partial solution, which would be instead of appointing judges to particular courts, of appointing federal judges to a general pool of federal judges from which individuals are drawn at random to serve on particular courts for limited periods of time. That would somewhat depoliticize the process by making the stakes lower for Supreme Court nominations because they wouldn't be directly appointed to the court.
Right.
Professor Lund, do you want to respond?
Yeah, sure. There are a lot of points there. When you start off with the quip there, my evidence indicates that this may be something that was taking place for a while, but it's something that's gotten much worse. You see very clearly over time it becoming progressive as the confirmation process itself has become more difficult. You see brighter and brighter and more influential nominees finding it harder and harder to get on the court. You know, it's not just the tide going up for everybody, but it, you can see these differences that are occurring there. You know, and I'll just mention briefly, you can go back 100 years ago and you'll find cases where Republicans will nominate Democrats to be on anything from the Supreme Court to appeals courts and vice versa. And stories, at least anecdotal stories, that the reason why they would nominate people from the other party is that, you know, they would ask lawyers who's the brightest guy in the country to be on the Supreme Court. And they would at least claim that, you know, they got names from, you know, in Cardozo's case when Hoover did it, because a lot of people said that Cardozo was the smartest nominee. And you'd see that Grover Cleveland, you'd see that for other presidents in the past. That's surely something that we wouldn't see happening right now. You mentioned writings. Well, I try to account for lots of factors, including not just the amount of writings, but what type of writings they did. And you see that these effects that I'm talking about occur even after you've tried to measure in many different ways the length of the paper trail that these nominees have. I've also tried in different ways, Kurt had mentioned ideology and stuff, that one interesting piece of data I have is surveys of lawyers who practice before judges to see whether or not the judges are ideologically biased in one way. And you find that even after you account for that, you still see this big effect based on based upon how smart or influential the judge is going to be. And you can look at, this last caller was mentioning looking at other types of government jobs, and it is striking to see how much more confrontational judicial appointments are than other things, even cabinet or sub-cabinet level positions. You know, if you believe that how much people fight over things is related to what's at stake, you know, nothing comes close to these judicial appointments. I mean, you not only see it across judicial appointments, so like something for the circuit, D.C. Circuit Court judgeship, under Bush, that was over 700 days average to go and get somebody confirmed to that bench. And then it'd be 360 days for circuit courts in general and 250 days or so for district court nominees. But, you know, this cabinet positions, sub-cabinet positions don't seem to be anywhere near as important, at least from senators' perspective, in terms of what they're willing to battle. I mean, you're talking about like 25-day average for sub-cabinet or cabinet-level positions, which is, you know, not even close. Now, with regard to this thing about randomly choosing judges that are in a pool, my guess is, I mean, the simplest solution, most direct, is to reduce the size and scope of government. That, I think, would reduce the amount that's at stake. But if you're going to put people in a pool, then the question becomes, have you just moved back the kind of the battle to the earlier stage of deciding who gets put in the pool? Who's going to be the gatekeeper for determining who's going to be put in this pool that's going to be randomly chosen from? And my guess is you just move this back a stage rather than solve it, given that there'll still be a lot that's at stake.
Although I guess it's interesting to note that, you know, the importance of the judicial slot does determine generally how bad the fight is. You know, Supreme Court fights are the worst, circuit court nominations second worst, district court nominations often are not controversial. And if you didn't know which of those courts the nominees were going to serve on, I guess it might all average out, but since most of them would wind up being district court judges, since that's where most of the slots are, maybe that would be a way to make it at least somewhat less contentious. If somebody had to decide which judges go in which courts after they're confirmed, then, of course, that would be where the fight would occur. But you said it would be determined randomly. It's an intriguing idea. I can't think of anything in the Constitution that that prohibits it. You know, in some sense, senators would be giving up, both president and senators would be giving up some of their power, since they wouldn't get to decide who goes where, and they may resist it for that reason. But again, it's an intriguing idea.
We've got three more questions pending, so let's go to our next caller.
Having put my name in several times for a judgeship at the district court level with little success in holding degrees from Yale and the University of Chicago, I must say I find your comments quite comforting. But my situation aside, what recommendations do our speakers have in terms of a prescription for getting politics out of the process in the book, if any?
Well, I think the only way you can really get it out is by having less at stake in terms of who you put on the court. And the most direct way is simply reducing the power of the federal courts. And the only way I think you can reduce that is by reducing the scope of the federal government. I mean, you see this huge increase in cases going to the federal court system when we had the EPA and all these other regulatory agencies being created in the late 60s and 70s that were there. Cases that wouldn't have even thought of existing or wouldn't have gone to federal courts all of a sudden were going there. So, I mean, that, unfortunately, given the increase that we've had in the scope of government over the last 4 or 5 years and the likely trend it will be to continue, at least in the near future, my guess is confirmation processes on average are just going to keep getting worse. I mean, the benefit that Obama has is he had one thing that also explains how hard these confirmations are is how much, whether the same party controls the Senate and how large a majority that they have there, and the fact that he had essentially a supermajority in during his first 2 years for most of the time, or was one vote short of that, I think kind of masks the general trend that we would be seeing occurring there. So, you know, I guess I'm not optimistic about the future in terms of solving this. I think we're going to have an ever more intrusive and controlling federal court system, simply because the government's becoming that way, and that means that the stakes are higher. And I just want to say one thing. When Kurt was going through the stuff about race and abortion and stuff, to me, a lot of that is just kind of smokescreen for going after people on their views, because if you look at these surveys of lawyers who practice before the judges, there's not a huge range in terms of the differences. You know, Republicans tend to be relatively similar. Democrats tend to be relatively similar to each other. The big difference, I think, that explains it is how smart these nominees are. That's the ones that they – I'll just give you one kind of example on the side, Harriet Myers. Harriet Myers, we knew what her views were on abortion. She had extremely strong views on abortion, even the case of rape and incest. You would think that that would send the Democrats over the barricades with regard to her. And yet you go and you look at the comments that Democrats had. Democrats were very favorably disposed to her. The people that didn't want her there were the Republicans. I mean, they wanted to have somebody, at least a lot of them wanted to have somebody who had strong views on abortion, but they objected to her because they viewed her as weak intellectually. And you can go through and look at all the quotes there from people saying that they're going to ask her questions like she was in law school when she would go through the hearing. And it was because of Republican opposition that she was withdrawn. Democrats had all sorts of nice things to say about her, even though abortion was the one issue that she clearly had a view on.
Yeah, you know, I don't have a lot of hope that we're going to succeed in making the federal government smaller or getting judges to adhere strictly to the Constitution, so I'll focus on some of the smaller things we could do. You know, you could have a rule that there has to be an up or down vote unless a supermajority says otherwise. And you can say, well, why not have, you know, all of them go through the process and get an up or down vote. Well, you know, you tend not to hear about it as publicly, but there are clearly nominees who, once their nominations get to the Judiciary Committee, both parties agree this is somebody who, either because of ethical reasons or other reasons, should not be on the courts, and you would want a way to sort of not put them through the whole process. But again, you often get supermajorities, if not unanimity, on them. So again, a supermajority could be the only way blocking an up or down vote. Again, you might need that to be a constitutional amendment if you really were going to have it, you know, survive from Senate to Senate. So that's probably the biggest problem there. You could have time limits, you know, say that, you can ask tough questions, but within, you know, you'll get out of Judiciary Committee in a certain number of months. You'll get on the floor within a certain number of months. You know, maybe you'll get filibustered, but at least you'll come to the top of the list within on the floor within 6 months of getting nominated. Again, you have a problem of how to enforce that across different Congresses. Some people would say getting rid of the filibuster. And certainly Reid would love to get rid of the judicial filibuster. But, you know, that's not as simple a fix as you might think, because especially if you look at what the Republicans have done with Obama's nominees, they haven't used the filibuster much, but what they've used is the fact that floor time is precious, and you don't need to filibuster. You need unanimous consent if you're going to, if Reid is going to get his way completely on the floor, and it's pretty hard to get unanimous consent, and the Republicans use that fact to cause Reid to have to burn a lot of floor time if he wants to have these votes on judicial and other nominees. And it's not enough of a priority to Reid, and some might say to Obama. So in the real world, where floor time is limited, even without a filibuster, there's a lot the minority can do to slow things down. I also have to agree with John that, Harriet Myers is a very interesting case in what it proves. You can compare that to Thomas, where liberals to this day would say that Thomas is not very bright. If that really were true, then we should have seen Democrats only too happy to have him on the court instead of a brighter conservative. But, of course, that was not the case. Democrats tried very hard to block him, and I think that's a testament to his intellect.
All right. Once again, we're speaking with Kurt Levy, who you just heard from, and also Professor John Laut, who's the author of Dumbing Down the Courts. We've got three questions pending, so let's go to our next caller.
Hi, I would like to know what we can learn from the states. The states have different processes for nominating justices. Some have nominating commissions, some have elections. And I'm wondering what the data at the state level can tell us about how to solve the problem at the federal level.
Well, I'm going to try to be shorter on my answers here, but that's an interesting question, and it'd be very interesting to go and do the research. If you look at the amount of data I had to collect to do what I thought was a good job on the federal level, you can see you're really talking about a really major undertaking for the states. But I think it would be something worthwhile to do. I mean, I think you'd be talking about, even to do a few states, I think you're talking about many thousands of hours of research time to go and gather the data. But that is something that's crossed my mind. I think it'd be a valuable thing to do.
Although, John, you're somewhat underselling your book in that you do cite some statistics from the states to show that things have also become more politicized on the state level.
Right. Going beyond that. He was talking about, I agree you can make that general comment, but to go into the type of analysis that I've done for the federal government for the states, I think would be a much bigger undertaking, but I appreciate that.
I gotcha. But yeah, I suspect you'd find similar things. I mean, you know, look, one of the Federalist Society and groups like it have been, somewhat successful both through educating the public and through judges that have been put on the courts and making the courts a little bit less activist, the federal courts. And what's happened, you know, the people who benefit from judicial activism have sort of moved their efforts to the states. The state courts have become more activist, and I suspect that's a big part of the reason why the battles have become more politicized. You know, look at what happened with retention elections, which used to be about as boring as could be because of what the Iowa Supreme Court did with declaring gay marriage to be a constitutional right. So again, I think you'd find the same link between activism and politicization of the confirmation process.
All right, still two questions pending, so let's head in the direction of our next caller.
Hey, John, I guess I wanted to start out by saying that I graduated from a top 10 law school, but I wonder if your basic theorem overlooks the fact that we're in a post-constitutional age now. I mean, where public policy is being made is in the courts and the administrative agencies. And that being the case, do you really want the best and the brightest as your judges anymore, or do we want more political appointees? You know, I look at the people who are at the top of my class and the editor of the Law Review, and I say, boy, do I really want those people making the social policy for the country? And I'm not really sure that I do. So let me just ask you that. Is your premise correct? Do we want the smartest people in the biggest and best law schools being our judges?
Right. Well, I mean, part of what I'm trying to show is the change that that the quality of people in terms of the smartest or most influential has been falling. Second question as you bring up is, do we want that? And I guess I think that there are trade-offs that are there. Surely there's lots of very difficult, complicated legal cases that come before the courts. And having people where billions of dollars or lives can be at stake and having people who are competent and being able to go and figure those types of things out, there's some benefit from doing that. But, you know, I think part of the reason why we do have these battles is for two reasons. One is the courts have become more powerful. Two, judges are doing what you're saying. They're more likely to go and kind of put in their own personal views and legislate from the bench. I mean, I've been at University of Chicago Law School. I was at Yale for a couple of years. And, you know, I think even the law schools kind of, at Yale, you'd sit in on a law school class that somebody else was teaching, and it's like 80% of the discussion would be on policy type things. At Chicago, it could be as high as 50%. Of course, if you took a class from Easterbrook or somebody like that, it'd be zero on policy discussions. But it's more, I think, a lot of young lawyers are being trained that this is kind of what lawyers do is policy stuff. So, I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I think that there's a trade-off, though, and it's a trade-off that maybe didn't exist as much 50 years ago.
I would also say to the caller, keep in mind that although we're most concerned with, that small fraction of cases that are bitterly fought out and highly ideological, you know, most cases still, thank God, probably remain relatively non-ideological, and judges decide them in a fairly straightforward manner applying the law. And there you certainly do want the smartest people. I would agree. If it's policy making they're doing, not so much. But if they're doing what judges do in most cases, I think you do want the smartest people. And, I do think you want people who have a well-thought-out judicial philosophy, and that doesn't come easily. You know, before I got involved in this process, I just assumed any half-smart lawyer, sort of understood the different judicial philosophies. And one thing I've learned is it's not. There's a lot of smart people out there, and some would say Harriet Myers is included, who just haven't given a lot of thought to judicial philosophy. And I think brighter people tend to sort of, understand the subtleties of judicial philosophy. And you might say, well, why do you need a judicial philosophy? Well, I think, if you don't have one, you tend to rely on a lot of soft thinking, sort of the empathy standard that Justice Sotomayor articulated. So I do think that we want smart judges, despite, as you point out, they may not always agree with us politically.
Well, John, you can be assured that I'll buy your book, and I'm encouraging our other listeners to buy it as well and read it, and I'll post a review on Amazon for you.
Right. I appreciate that very much. Thank you. Yeah, at the beginning of the book, I have a discussion about how frequently. In fact, judges tend to agree with each other that, you know, maybe some of these hot button issues that you see this type of policy. So I think it is for the vast majority of cases you're going to care about having the smartest people on. It may not be some of the ones that get people most interested, but anyway, I appreciate the question.
Looks like we have time for a final question, so let's head there.
So my question relates to the financial pressures. I mean, in light of the huge disparity, financial disparity between judicial incomes versus what smart lawyers can make in-house or, you know, at a law firm, I mean, we've seen a number of, you know, very brilliant lawyers that have resigned from the bench in the past couple years. Mike Ludig, McConnell, Cassells, when you in Utah, you know, where they've expressly, you know, talked about the financial pressures having to send kids to college. I mean, don't we think that a lot of very fine lawyers are either not putting their names in, or you know, or turning down when they're approached, sort of self-selecting out, because frankly, the money is so bad compared with what they can make off of the bench, and that may be a real driver as to why there may be increased mediocrity on the bench?
Right. No, well, there are two things here. One is whose names get put into the hopper to begin with, and it could be either for the financial reasons that you're talking about and or you know, expectations about having to go through a brutal confirmation process that dissuades people. I can't discern. I don't have any data to try to discern how much of that can be explained by those two different factors. They both are changing pretty much together. What I can say is that conditional on being nominated, what happens, how difficult of a process do you face, and what's happens to your probability of being confirmed. And I can say that brighter people have a much more difficult time and they're less likely to get confirmed. I mean, when you see the fact that, you know, somebody who went to a top 10 law school, served on law review, clerked for a circuit court judge, clerked for a Supreme Court justice, having about a 37% lower probability after you control for lots of other factors that are there, probability of getting confirmed. I mean, that's a pretty substantial difference that's there, and it's something that's increased over time. And so I agree, there are two questions. Who gets nominated? And I tried, but you don't know who was approached. I mean, I talked to, when I was writing the book, because of the schools I had been at, I knew some people who had been approached, and I talked to them, and at least anecdotally, some of them would raise the prospect of just not wanting to go and deal with the confirmation process that's there. But I can say, and I try to acknowledge in the book, that there can be these different factors for whether their name gets in the hopper, but we only see data on people who once they are nominated.
Well, that just goes to show the problem is, you know, the number of smart people or good people generally who are being scared away is worse than we can imagine, since we don't
right.
know all the people who don't let their names be put in the hopper. You know, look, the very least we could do is have judges' salaries keep up with inflation, and that has not been happening in the last 25 years or so. And that not only is that just good public policy, but that would also, you know, I think help conservatives somewhat, because you know, the smart liberal people are more likely to be professors or at the ACLU or community organizers and not making huge salaries. Republicans are a little bit more likely to go to the big firms or to become in-house counsel. And that's why Republicans probably have been a somewhat louder voice on helping judges keep up with inflation. Although, to be fair, I think the Democrats recognize that problem, too.
Yeah. I mean,
Professor Lott, we're up on the hour here, but I want to give you the last word if you want to express a final thought here.
Oh, well, thanks. I want to thank the Federal Society for having this. I greatly appreciate this. Look, just to emphasize, I do find this effect for both nominees, Republican and Democratic, though, as I think my results pretty clearly show, the smartest Republican nominees have a somewhat more difficult time getting confirmed, somewhat more difficult time going through the confirmation process than smart Democrats do. And I think, you know, we focus so much on these issues like abortion and what have you, but I think it more comes down to, you know, kind of what they do rather than what they say are the reasons for it. And I think the real focus, the real opposition from your political opponents is on the smartness or the potential influence that your nominees are going to have, not necessarily what their views are and not what their paper trail is. And the interesting thing to me is also how well your political opponents are able to kind of predict who will be the most influential. Because if you go back and look to see, if you look to see who's the most influential now, they had the most difficult times getting confirmed. So, you know, they don't, we only know later who's on the court, how influential they are by their citations to their opinions. But your political opponents seem to do a very good job at guessing who's going to be the most influential and give them the hardest time.
So I just want to, I wanted to finish just by thanking John for this book in a debate that's been so clouded by statistics carelessly thrown around. It's great to have a comprehensive book like this to go to.
Well, thank you.
And on behalf of the Federalist Society, let me thank both Kurt Levy and Professor John Lott. Again, John Lott is the author of the book we've been talking about, Dumbing Down the Courts, How Politics Keeps the Smartest Judges Off the Bench, available on Amazon.com, and a link to that page is available in the notice you received for this call and also on the Federalist Society's website. To our audience, check our website as well for a schedule of upcoming Teleforum conference calls, but until our next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.